Coming up, Lucky Severson reports on cities trying to clean up their downtowns, not only by evicting those living on the streets, but now by making it against the law for caregivers to help them. Also, Kim Lawton on the once-in-a-lifetime calendar convergence of Thanksgiving and Hanukkah. It's being called Thanksgivica. And comfort dogs who soothe the pain of people who are hurting.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. More evidence this week of the growing divide in the United Methodist Church over homosexuality. A United Methodist pastor was convicted by his fellow pastors for officiating at his son's same-sex wedding. Reverend Frank Schaefer of Lebanon County, Pennsylvania, will be forced to leave the ministry if he doesn't withdraw his support of same-sex marriage within 30 days. He pledged to continue performing gay marriages and says he expects to be defrocked. The denomination's official position is, quote, "The practice of homosexuality is incompatible with Christian teaching." Other church trials over the issue are expected. Faith-based relief groups are continuing efforts in the Philippines to help victims of Typhoon Haiyan. Over 5,000 people are believed to be dead, and an estimated 4 million were displaced. Religious organizations have been among those delivering food, water, and emergency supplies, as well as working to establish interim shelters. But many are finding it difficult to raise money for their work. A new survey from the Pew Research Center found the Philippines' crisis is drawing less attention and fewer donations from the American public than several other international disasters in recent years, including the Haiti earthquake in 2010 and the Indian Ocean tsunami in 2004. Meanwhile, relief efforts are also underway here in the U.S. as religious groups have been mobilizing to help victims of last weekend's deadly tornadoes in the Midwest. Congregations from across the country have been delivering aid and sending in teams of volunteers. Faith-based counselors are also on the scene trying to help victims cope in the wake of the devastation. At the White House this week, recipients of the Presidential Medal of Freedom included the Reverend C.T. Vivian, a veteran leader of the Civil Rights Movement. Vivian worked alongside Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. in the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. He was also one of the original Freedom Riders who were beaten and jailed for their efforts to end segregation. Also this week, the Obamas and Clintons visited the tomb of John F. Kennedy at Arlington National Cemetery. November 22nd was the 50th anniversary of Kennedy's assassination. That tragedy completely overshadowed the death on the same day of Clive Staples Lewis, C.S. Lewis, widely considered one of the world's most influential writers about the Christian faith. He taught English literature at Oxford and also wrote Mere Christianity, The Screwtape Letters, The Chronicles of Narnia, and other books that still sell up to 2 million copies a year. Lewis was an atheist who became a Christian. He called himself the most reluctant convert in all England. He was 64 years old. In a narrow vote, the U.S. Supreme Court this week declined to block a Texas law that places greater restrictions on the state's abortion clinics. The law requires doctors who perform abortions in clinics to have admitting privileges at a nearby hospital. Opponents say the law prevents a third of the state's abortion clinics from providing services. Meanwhile, voters in Albuquerque, New Mexico, rejected a referendum that would have banned late-term abortions after 20 weeks of pregnancy. New government estimates this week show a slight decline in the number of homeless people in the country. Still, on one night in late January, Roughly 610,000 people were homeless across the country, a third of them with no shelter. A quarter were children under 18, and nearly 58,000 were veterans. As cities try to clean up their downtowns, where many homeless gather, some are targeting not only the homeless, but caregivers trying to help them. Lucky Severson reports.
Sunday morning in Moore Park, a historic square in Raleigh, North Carolina. Hugh Hollowell is a pastor of the Mennonite Church and founder of the Love Wins Ministry, a congregation of homeless people he has been feeding on weekends for over 6 years. So he was stunned when he showed up one Sunday morning late this summer.
We were greeted for the first time ever with numerous police cars. Police officer tells us, you can't be here. You can't set up. You can't share food. I think he said you can't feed people. And I said, why not? What, you know? And he said, you're violating an ordinance.
The old, rarely used ordinance said the pastor could apply for a permit, but it would cost him $800 for each day he came offering food.
And I said, why are we just now? We've been doing this for 6.5 years. Why are you just now doing this? And he said, sir, I'm not here to debate you. I'm here to tell you what is. If you persist, you will be arrested.
And so about 100 people, some of whom had not eaten for 24 hours, left hungry. So why, after all these years, did the city of Raleigh suddenly crack down on feeding the homeless? It's known that the Downtown Business Alliance had complained about customers being discouraged from coming to their stores by both the feeding and the loitering. The homeless speak of another reason. Like Stephen, he's homeless after holding a job for 19 years.
It's a change in the whole area to more upper class. You're trying to get the people out of here to put apartments and so forth in.
There are hundreds of communities and cities throughout the country that are buffing up their downtown and removing the homeless in the process. They say it's not only good for business, it's good for the homeless. Critics, many of them pastors, say it's simply a matter of out of sight, out of mind, and that it's morally wrong.
Many cities feel that in order to develop their cities, especially their downtown areas, they need to present a very, what they consider attractive appearance, and that doesn't include the sight of visible poverty.
Maria Foscarinas is founder of the National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty.
In each of these cities, there was some type of criminalizing ordinance, some kind of ordinance that prohibited sleeping in public, sleeping in a particular public place, sleeping in parks, begging, activities that essentially you have to carry out in public if you're homeless. So hundreds of cities, at a minimum, across the country are adopting this kind of law. Overall, I would say that communities are, or cities are, criminalizing homelessness faster than we can oppose these efforts.
One of those cities is Columbia, South Carolina. The state capital has embarked on a crusade to revitalize downtown. The leader of that campaign is Councilman-at-Large Cameron Runyon. He says what galvanized the revitalization was a letter from the boss of one of downtown's anchor stores.
It said, we cannot sustain our business model if you guys don't address the problem of unresponded to poverty in the heart of your city. It's killing our ability to engage commerce. So we have opened an emergency shelter here in the city, and we have made provision for all who are willing, who want to go, to have help at this emergency shelter.
But the budget for Columbia's only city-operated shelter is less than a half of what the city itself projects is needed. And there are only 250 beds. It's estimated that on any given day, Columbia has over 1,600 homeless. And beyond that, it's generally recognized that shelters are far from appropriate or helpful for every homeless person.
Nobody is forced to go to the shelter, but what they are forced to do is they're forced to abide by the laws of this city.
What if you're sleeping out on the street right out here?
You're going to get arrested.
And you'll go to jail.
It is not legal to sleep on the streets in the city of Columbia.
Of course they have a point. No one wants people to be sleeping on the sidewalk. The people themselves don't want to be on the sidewalk. The point is, what do you do about it?
Councilman Runyon believes he has a long-term answer to that question. It's phase two of a master plan he proposes to fix the city's homelessness once and for all.
I'm very supportive of the concept of a retreat, and let me tell you what, in my mind, what that is. That is a very large tract of land, 500 to 1,000 acres. Pristine, a place that you or I or anyone watching this would love to go to.
The tract of land is 12 to 15 miles outside of Columbia. Runyon maintains this retreat would be similar in concept to where the wealthy who need help would go to a retreat in, say, Florida, far away from negative influences.
We don't have a retreat yet, but when we do, we're not going to force anyone to go to a retreat that doesn't want to go to the retreat.
The city has invited proposals to deal with its homeless problem. Councilman Runyon's idea of building an out-of-town retreat is provoking strong opposition.
There has to be, and there is, other answers to the question at hand. You know, housing for people can be done within the city itself, within the downtown area, at least within the bus system.
John Dawkins is with a nonprofit that provides housing, some counseling, and training to about 250 homeless, over a third of whom are currently employed, also known as underemployed. He says the councilman's plan will actually result in more homelessness.
You're ripping people out of their environment, you're ripping them out of their safety zone, and you're taking communities and you're pulling those apart. And any chance a person has of moving forward is gone. They're going to go live on the river again or live in the wood encampment areas.
He says he's active in the downtown community and doesn't think homeless should be allowed to loiter or disturb people, but should be treated with dignity. People like Winnie Boiler up in Raleigh, a school teacher who lost her house after she lost her job, notwithstanding two master's degrees.
I don't even want to tell nobody how much education I got. And I ended up like this. I even question myself, and I can't question God, but I got him. I need for him to show me what to do, because I don't know right now. I really don't know.
And it's not only the homeless who are wondering where to turn. It's also the people who are trying to help them.
This is a more recent trend, a new twist. The most extreme example was actually making this a crime to offer food to people in public places. But short of that, there are also efforts to make it extremely difficult to the point of being impossible to offer food in public places to people who are poor or homeless.
Our thing with the city is that I don't want to be out here either, okay? I would much rather sleep in on Sunday morning. I don't want to be out here either. But if you're the way you critique what I'm doing is you come up with something better.
Something that Pastor Hollowell felt was better did emerge after he gained a lot of support for his protests over the police stopping him from feeding the homeless. It's a city-owned building right across the street from Moore Park, where the homeless will soon have shelter, and it's hoped not be in the way of downtown revitalization. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Lucky Severson in the Carolinas.
On our calendar, this week marks a once-in-a-lifetime convergence. Thanksgiving Day will also be the first full day of Hanukkah, the Jewish Festival of Lights. Hanukkah celebrates the restoration of the Jewish temple in Jerusalem by the Maccabees in the 2nd century BCE. The rare coming together of Hanukkah and Thanksgiving has inspired unique celebrations and a unique nickname, Thanksgivica. Kim Lawton reports from Plymouth, Massachusetts.
At Kahila Schechter Academy in Norwood, Massachusetts, third graders are making a timeline.
Before we could even have Thanksgivica, we needed to have the Maccabees starting that war.
From the 2nd century BCE, when the Jewish Maccabees fought against Greek Assyrian oppressors in Israel, to the 17th century, when the pilgrims landed just a few miles down the road. Here at the closest Jewish day school to Plymouth Rock, Thanksgivica is huge.
Imagine Judah Maccabee sitting down to roast turkey.
Rabbi David Paskin, co-head of the school, wrote the Ballad of Thanksgivica, which the students performed in a YouTube video that went viral. The song imagines turkeys stuffed with Hanukkah pancakes or latkes, and the Jewish Judah Maccabee serving potatoes to the Native American Squanto. But Paskin says underneath the lighthearted tone is something very meaningful.
I think if there is a quintessential challenge for American Jews, it's how do we live fully as Americans and how do we live fully as Jews? And to have a moment in time where those two come together, not in conflict but in celebration, is a real moment that we should celebrate.
Because the Jewish calendar is based on a lunar cycle, from year to year, Hanukkah begins on different dates during late fall or early winter. Thanksgiving is always the fourth Thursday in November. This year, for the first time since the 1800s, the first full day of Hanukkah coincides with Thanksgiving Day. And according to some calculations, it won't happen again for almost 80,000 years. The convergence has resonated deeply with Jews across the country. There are numerous websites offering holiday mashup recipes for things like sweet potato latkes with cranberry sauce and roast turkey brined in Manischewitz wine. And of course, all the special merchandise, including T-shirts and turkey-shaped menorahs, known as menurkies. This is Plymouth, where tradition says the pilgrims first landed in 1620 and may well have celebrated the first Thanksgiving the following year. Because it's close by, the Jewish community of Greater Boston has been very enthusiastic about celebrating Thanksgivica.
This is a once-in-a-lifetime celebration for our community.
Jeremy Burton is executive director of the Jewish Community Relations Council here. He's thrilled that Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick has declared Thanksgivica 2013 an official holiday.
So now it's not just a song, it's also a state holiday.
Because Hanukkah usually falls in December, it is often tied to Christmas. But many Jews believe the themes may actually be a better fit with Thanksgiving. At the historic Vilna Shul in Boston's Beacon Hill neighborhood, a group of young Jewish professionals called Havura on the Hill sponsored a special Thanksgivica-themed Sabbath gathering.
What's really interesting about Thanksgivica is that it's combining two holidays that really embrace being with your family and building community.
Guest speaker at the event was Malka Benjamin, an observant Jew who is an historical interpreter and plays a pilgrim at the historic Plymouth Plantation. She sees strong ties between the Jewish experience and that of the Puritans, or separatists.
There's definitely a persecution connection. You know, most of the Jewish holidays are, they tried to kill us, we survived, so we celebrate. That definitely happens on Hanukkah. And the separatists are persecuted. Really, they're prosecuted. They're breaking the law in England. In the 17th century, by law, you must be a member of the Church of England, which is why they flee to Holland and ultimately come here.
Rabbi Paskin brought Kahila Schechter students on a field trip to Plymouth Plantation, where visitors can see what early colonial life was like. He hopes Thanksgivica can be an opportunity for Jews to learn more about the Puritans, who were also a religious minority.
What is your roof made out of?
Well, that's what.
Of course, the story of Hanukkah is a story of religious freedom. It's a story of a people yearning to truly live as full Jews and yet also be fully integrated into a secular society. The story of Thanksgiving is of pilgrims yearning for their own religious freedom and trying to find their identity in a new world that they did not even know yet.
Many in the Jewish community are using Thanksgivica as a springboard to encourage special charitable efforts.
This is an opportunity to also give back to the community, to recognize that there are some who don't have food on their tables, to acknowledge that we are all immigrants here, or at least most of us are, and to celebrate what makes America great.
In Boston, combined Jewish philanthropies and Jewish Big Brothers Big Sisters partnered for a toy drive called Project Dreidel, named for the popular Hanukkah spinning top.
Thanksgiving is about being grateful for what we have. And as it relates to Hanukkah, I think that certainly it gives families the opportunity while they're exchanging gifts amongst their families to do something for children in need.
Stephanie Zelkind is director of the Jewish Teen Funders Network and has blogged about practical ways families can incorporate giving into Thanksgivica celebrations.
In Judaism, we have the value of tzedakah, which is a commandment, in fact, to give. It's not just a nice thing to do, but something we're required to do. So to come together as a family, talk about what matters to us and what kind of change do we want to make in the world, and then go out and do it.
One idea is to put a tzedakah box in the middle of the dinner table instead of a centerpiece.
And every guest is invited over the course of dinner to put something into the tzedakah box. It could be a quarter, it could be $100, it could be a check for even more. And over dessert, we talk about where we would like that money to go and what kind of gift we would like to make together as a family. While Thanksgivica is a unique opportunity, I hope that the traditions we begin this year will last for the future.
Paskin says behind it all is the spiritual value of gratitude, something he says should be core to Jews and non-Jews alike.
Abraham Joshua Heschel teaches us about radical amazement, that we should look at the world and be radically amazed at what we see, that we can be having this conversation, that the sun came up this morning. If we can look at the world and be amazed by what we see and realize that every moment is a blessing, it's an opportunity to be grateful. Just imagine how enriched our lives would be.
Indeed, Paskin and other Jewish leaders say all Americans can benefit from reflecting on many of the values highlighted by Thanksgivica, values such as responding to religious intolerance.
For non-Jews and Jews, it's to look at the breadth of responses that we've had throughout time to the struggle for religious freedom. And what is that struggle going to look like for the next generation? How are we going to teach our children what it means to honor and to respect different cultures and different traditions?
The story of the Mayflower and the story of the Pilgrims is about people coming to this country to build a community rooted in values for their children and to build a community rooted in their understanding of their history and, frankly, their reading of the Bible. Over the last centuries, millions of people have come to Boston and have really appreciated that this is a place for building an American idea. And that idea, which started as one faith community, the Pilgrims, has really grown into an interfaith community.
And that, they say, is definitely something to celebrate.
Let's celebrate across America.
I'm Kim Lawton in Plymouth, Massachusetts.
Happy holidays, Thanksgiving.
Finally, the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod has a remarkable ministry to people who hurt, and it's busy these days helping many of the victims of the tornadoes in the Midwest. It's called the Canine Comfort Dog Ministry. The group also sent comfort dogs to Newtown, Connecticut after the school shooting there, and to Boston after the Marathon bombing. The ministry is based in Addison, Illinois, and it works because dogs seem especially sensitive to the pain of others. We spoke with Tim Hetzner, the president of Lutheran Church Charities.
People many times, all ages, will talk to a dog before they'll talk to a person. After a couple seconds of petting the dog, people start sharing why they're there or what they're thinking or some of their fears. But you know, through all of that, it brings a smile to their face, some hope into their day. And if they want, we will pray with them if they would like that. Dogs are part of God's creation, a very gifted part of His creation with their sixth sense of empathy, to sense someone who is hurting. I can't tell you how many times our dogs, and they're trained not to be aggressive with people, but will nudge the handler to go see someone, and we'll invite them over, and it's somebody that is struggling. Dogs sense that in people. All of our dogs have a business card, and on their business card is a picture of the dog, and it has a Bible verse. Here's Ruthie's, Ephesians 4:2. They all have Facebook pages, Twitter accounts, and email, which isn't just being cute. It's a way to continue to minister to and to connect with people. And many times people will share things that they're going through or will ask for prayers through the Facebook page. You know, I have not found in the Gospels yet where Jesus ever invited someone to synagogue or temple. But I do see all over the place where Jesus calls us to go out. And it's not just go out, but he always says where to start. And you start with the lowliest and those that are hurting. And those that are in the lowly places, and those that are suffering. And that's what we do as the hands and the feet of Christ.
That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. And visit our website where there's always much more and where you can listen to or watch each of our programs. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, the Ballad of Thanksgivica, video from Kahila Schechter Academy in Norwood, Massachusetts.
Happy holidays, Thanksgivica. Happy holidays, Thanksgivica. Happy holidays, Thanksgivica.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.